Hey there, ho there. You're listening to Super Tool Shed, the only podcast on the internet where the audience has as much idea when the next episode will be as the hosts. I'm Bennett the Sage, I'm joined by Mark the Engineer, and today's way overdue episode is playing catch up with our lives. That was until we heard a little announcement about the casting of one of our favorite Valkyrie bitches. Yes, it seems that Scarlett Johansson has been slated to don the invisible skin-tight suit and Oculus Rift to play Motoko Kusanagi. Scarlett Johansson playing Motoko Kusanagi. It's gonna be an angry episode, that's for sure, but first, the pleasantries. Mark, how have you been?
Happy New Year!
Merry Christmas, a tip-top Ted, a crazy Kwanzaa, and all that good shit.
How have I been? Let's start this off the show by saying that, once again, it's not that we're not recording Tool Shed, or it's not that Tool Shed's not happening. It's that we haven't been recording it. And also, Bennett won't stop playing his goddamn PS4.
I'm sorry I'm enjoying my birthday gift, okay? Somebody spends $400 on a very nice piece of tech, you're kind of inclined to use it. Otherwise, you look ungrateful. Like, listen, I can't help it that you grew up poor.
Remind me to never buy you a gun.
Listen, if you buy me a nickel-plated Gat for $500, I will find black people to shoot.
Wow. Because that's the world we live in now, folks. It's okay. No one will convict him.
Yeah, I know. We're getting political here on Super Tool Shed. And as you can tell, I've had a few, so I have stopped giving fucks.
Like, good! Drunkle Betty's back! First episode of the year, and it's time for Drunkle Betty! Oh, that's good. Last time it was Jews and the superiority of white gamers. I have no idea where this is going. Alright, so, how have I been?
This Drunkle Benny episode is brought to you by Buchanan's Deluxe Blended Scotch Whiskey. You know it's great because Deluxe is capitalized with a D and an L.
Oh dear.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you even get that?
Oh, Buchanan's? It's at my local Safeway. It sounds much fancier than it actually
does. Like, now I'm disappointed. At least when I say Black Eagle, it's like, yeah, like this drunk podcast is brought to you by Black Eagle Whiskey. It's brought to you by The Total Wine. It's in-house, blah, blah. Right. But for you, it's like, yeah, I got it at Gennardi's.
Well, I try to be a little interesting with whatever I'm drinking for, as far as recording, just to see if there's like a difference whether I'm drunk on bourbon or I'm drunk on scotch or I'm drunk on rum, which will never happen again because I'm never drinking rum for the rest of my life.
It sounds so good because now you've turned into Benny D. Williams.
Well, actually, can I share a quick story about why I never drink rum?
Good. Yes. Let's kick off.
This has nothing to do. This doesn't have something to do with me, but this has something to do with our good friend Gabe. Now, Gabe, doesn't make enough to afford the fancy alcohol. So I said, like, you know what? I'm gonna get him some very fancy rum. So I got him some great rum. And we decided that we're just gonna like hang out in my house and damn the consequences what happens. So I'm enjoying some rum and coke, and he's enjoying his rum and coke, except that he's pounding his rum and coke with an entire family-sized bag of Skittles. So he's just like finishing off the rum, not even bothering with the RC Cola anymore. He's just like pounding rum, munching down the Skittles as fast as he can. And then about 2 hours later, while I'm fast asleep, I hear him trying to puke into my sink. So I just kind of lead him into the bathroom, and he's puking his guts out of my toilet, and it will not stop. He's puking like it was The Exorcist. He was just continually pulsing out this god-awful bile, and all he could do is just look at me and say, like, man, I ought to be thanking you for this. Why? And he says, because I never knew what my limit was before now, and now I do. And he's just puking and puking into my toilet. I'm flushing like like 20 minutes. Like every 4 minutes I'm flushing the toilet because it's gotten so full. And then he decides to take a shower and he starts puking down my bathroom.
Oh my God.
And then, you know, I just kind of usher him off into the bathroom, out of the bathroom. It's like, you okay? You okay? He's like, I'm fine. And then he sleeps on the extra mattress. And from that day on, I resolved to say I will never drink rum again, because that just makes people fucking sick.
Well, now, honestly, I've had rum perfectly fine, but then again, I don't drink like an idiot and pound fucking Skittles like my name was Rainbow fucking Smashed, so...
Or Marshawn Lynch. That's a Seattle Seahawks joke right there.
And given that, now that I've had this wonderful Cosby sweater story, because that's the only thing that I can imagine what it would look like.
It was puke brown. It was puke brown. It was just... It wasn't even rainbow colored. It was something along the lines of how... You know, like how you like run into mud with your car, and it just kind of had that kind of consistency of like freshly treaded mud.
This is how we're starting the year.
Ain't it great?
Oh.
This is what happens with Drunkle Benny. So, Mark, how have you been?
It's been a long few months. That's for damn sure. let's go down the list. This is now a podcast of bachelors. Hey!
I didn't publicly announce my, splitting with my, ex. We're still on good terms. It was a kind of a mutual split. We just kind of realized we didn't live well together when we had 2 weeks to ourselves. So we just felt like, you know, we're still sexually attracted to each other, but we shouldn't pursue it further than that.
So, yeah, We're now about cats of bachelors, because before it was one or the other, but never both, and then it was both, and now it's none.
Oh God! And
just get me my fucking Gamergate shirt.
You know, we went like 5 months without mentioning that shit on this podcast. Must we start now?
No, we shouldn't, because to name it is to give it power. So that happened. Work continues on my various dealings in our secret project. So that's been like, which involved me having to build a new computer, which is fun.
Build a new computer funded by whom?
Funded by patrons and all the work that I do. So I don't care how drunk you are.
No, by a particular individual.
Oh. Oh, your mom.
Yes. My mama Sage decided that she keeps abreast of my personal life as best as she can, and she doesn't know anything about what I do. She just likes to know who I work with, and I talked to her about Mark, and she is a person who is generous with her money when she feels that the need is there, and the need is certainly there as far as Mark is concerned when it comes to trying to do what we're trying to do. So we're planning to thank her in the final project, but I feel that this should be the first public acknowledgement of what she has contributed for this project and for you as an artist. So Mama Sage, a round of applause.
Yeah. Thank you, Mama Sage. Honestly, I'm still not running the best hardware, but I don't really feel like I need to be running the best hardware, just because every time I seem to try and get the best of the best thing, none of it fits together right. So...
and the best of the best right now is an Intel processor that's about $1,000 more than the AMD equivalent.
Yeah, so I went with a 9590, which is 8 cores, running at 4.7 gigahertz, and it's slick. Unfortunately, like, once again, you know, I have to be different, because, you know, I don't buy an iPhone, I don't buy a Galaxy, and that means it's hard for me to buy phone cases. I don't buy into fucking Intel's monopolistic bullshit, so, of course, the program that I'm using, which is Blender, is more Intel friendly than it is AMD friendly, and the Cycles engine, which is what makes everything in Blender look super duper pretty, at the cost of time and rendering, unfortunately will never be as good on my processor, on my rig, as it would be if I were running a full Intel rig with a huge ass fucking NVIDIA graphics card. But at the very least, I finally do. I've come back to the NVIDIA graphics card.
Because Radeon, what did it do to you?
Oh my god, yeah, I forgot.
Prepare for a story, ladies and gentlemen. I was not here as it happened.
It's not really a huge story, but in building the new rig, it started out with a graphics card, and the graphics card was, okay, well, I've been playing AMD ball for years and years and years, like, since my, I think it was, god, what was it? My GeForce 2 disintegrated, like, the capacitors on it, like, the solder for the capacitors on my GeForce 2 years and years ago had just disintegrated, and the capacitors, like, I found them in the bottom of my case. And I said, well, I'm definitely not doing this anymore. So at that point, I went to AMD, because it's like, well, AMD makes the best hardware, even though Catalyst is a fucking joke. So I got the 290X, and reviews on the 290X are great. It does this, it does that, it's fantastic. Fucking Crossfire with it is great. Except I ran into a problem where every 10 minutes my screen would turn black and never turn back on. System wasn't crashing, it's just that the card itself had this black screening problem that everyone failed to mention. And what was best about this was the fact that this black screening problem has been a problem at that point for a year and a half, and AMD has not seen fit to fix it. And I went, well, then I guess I'm going to have to go back to NVIDIA. Let's start talking about NVIDIA cards. And I went I got the GTX 770, and 29 days later, as if to say, you chose poorly, NVIDIA announces the 900 series and says that the 700 series is being discontinued. And I went, oh my fucking god.
Didn't we find out that the 900 series is basically an overclocked version of the 7 series?
It's like, I don't know all the individual P's and Q's because I was too angry to continue reading. It's as close as you can get to a Titan without spending Titan money.
Give it 2 additional years, maybe that won't be the case.
Which, you know, that's all well and good, but 29 days, man!
I know, the cycle...
29 days.
The cycle of technological progression is a bitch if you find yourself at the wrong end of it. I found that out the hard way when I went to my family's for Christmas, and I went to I was talking with my cousin who's been in part of the tech industry for longer than I've been alive. And he was talking about like how cell phone cameras have gotten so good at the streamlining process of editing these videos have gotten so... you know, stream like have gotten so quick that it's basically killed the prosumer market. He gives the prosumer market as far as camera equipment, as far as lighting, as far as editing, a 1 year, maybe 2, before it's just pro level.
Mm.
And that is, you know, like for somebody who's working with an aging camera that was designed in 2007, then built in 2009, and now it's 2015. And I'm beginning to see the wears and tears on the camera. Like, this episode is being recorded before the January 14th episode of Anime Abandoned is being released. But I've noticed that when I'm looking at the footage back, that the camera, that the footage looks fuzzier than usual. Like, the autofocus is starting to show, like, it's not as quick as it used to be.
Yeah, which just means that the motor's wearing out, which is, you know, fine. See, the thing is... is that we already had a conversation about equipment a few months ago, and the conversation was, you know, like when the Patreon first started, like, oh, we can get, you know, like this equipment and this equipment, and, you know, work on sound dampening in your room. And I'm just kind of sitting here like, if sound is a problem against the shotgun, get a lapel mic, but the camera's fine. And now the camera's becoming increasingly not fine, but it's not like, you know, you're starved for a new camera.
It's one of those things that's like, I'm noticing the wear and tear on the camera, and I'm noticing, like, you know, like, I notice it, and maybe you don't notice it as the viewer just wants to pay attention to what the guy on camera says about this particular shitty anime. But, you know, when you're working behind the scenes, you have to pay attention to what your lighting, what your video camera, what your sound is doing. Otherwise, your audience knows. And when your audience knows, you have failed as a professional.
Yeah, it's true. And the promise is that we're going to keep on top of it, because obviously if this camera goes dead, then Anime Abandon's going to be late one of these months.
And I guarantee you this, that will not happen. If I sense that this camera is going, you know, down the shithole, I will purchase a new camera, and it will be a much better camera, much more up to date, and one that I don't have to rely on SD cards.
No, you'll still rely on SD, because the problem that we ran into when we filmed Violence Jack was we had my camera, which was the Vixia in the generation before Bennett's camera, and then we have Bennett's camera, which is the newer one. And before I showed up, I said, okay, so there's a firmware update that allows for the use of high density SD cards, so I'm just going to install that firmware. Works perfectly fine. We go looking for that firmware for his camera. Oh no, you need to send it to the Kodak store or to the Canon store. And we need to do it directly. And I'm like, why?
I don't know why they do. Like, you could shoot perfectly good 1080p footage on an SD card, but I can't do that because the bitrate, for whatever reason, it just gets choked when it goes on an SD card. So actually, I'm not shooting true 1080p footage when I'm shooting on my camera. I'm shooting 1440 by 1280, which for some reason equals somewhat 1080p, but not quite.
I'll say that it looks It looks good on a TV. Like when I sling Anime Abandon over to the Chromecast, all the shots of you look perfectly fine. And I just continue to think it's funny that, you know, like, you spend so much, like, you have the better camera than I do, but you have to send us your camera if you want the full experience. It's like, wasn't $1,000 worth the full experience?
it became a point of discussion between us, because we were discussing whether or not it was worth sending the camera over to Canon to get this firmware update if it meant that I could shoot true 1080p on an SD card. And I said, like, no, because if for whatever reason, if I send my camera to them, it gets lost, then I am completely, you know, up the creek without a paddle. Over, like, a difference that you can't even see on a true 720p television.
The thing is that it was less about the definition. That was just kind of a perk. The point was to get it to get you from a disk drive based system to flash memory, so that transfers went faster.
Which kind of became a moot point when we realized that the flash card reader on my PC was a dud.
Yeah, and that still pisses me off to this day, but fuck it, who cares? you've got USB 3 and external SATA, so when the new camera comes, it'll just be like, okay, fine, straight to the USB 3 port. There, done. Is everybody happy now?
Yes, everyone will be happy, because I will make sure that the new camera is DSLR capable.
And what else has gone on? Honestly, the last quarter just kicked my ass and was intent on making me miserable all day, every day, which is part of the reason why it is that Tool Shed was hard to do, if only because, you know, like, I'm spending more time talking to Bennett about my problems than I am talking about, oh, did you see the Ant-Man trailer?
Oh god, what a trailer that wasn't. You know, that trailer was so underwhelming that it's not even worth talking about. Here's my impression of the Ant-Man trailer. You know, Marvel is proving that I am right about my jaded view about the release schedule.
I got no defense for it. The Ant-Man trailer was wholesale disappointing. It's people walking into rooms while Michael Douglas talks. Like, it's...
Yeah, you know, what a slap in the face Michael Douglas was in that trailer.
You know, I'll take Michael Douglas in the same way that, you know, I mean, Redford made more sense in Captain America because he's fucking Redford, but you know, like Michael Douglas is just like, I guess he just wanted a piece of that superhero money.
You know, at that case, like in that case, why not get like Warren Beatty? Like Warren Beatty could play any
role.
Dude,
I would kill to see fucking Warren Beatty show up. Are you kidding?
I know, right? Like, what the hell is Warren Beatty doing? Nothing. So put him in one of your superhero movies so he could be relevant again. Like, you know, like Robert Redford became relevant in Captain America 2.
Yeah, man. Fucking Warren Beatty would be fucking... Oh, man. Now I just want to go back and watch Dick Tracy.
Oh. You're the only guy I know who gave that movie half a chance. Like, I tried... Go ahead.
I love Dick Tracy to this day. Kidding me?
Man, that movie had as many problems as Sin City has and still does, both in its first movie and second movie. And I would argue that it has more more problems regarding it, but I can't be angry at it. I think
going back, when I really think back of my movie watching history, I think Dick Tracy was the first comic book film I ever saw.
You saw it before Batman?
I think I saw it before Batman.
Oh, we're talking about Tim Burton Batman, by the way.
I'm genuinely looking back, because the comic book films that came out when we were kids who actually had a sense of self and watching the things that we liked to watch, were Dick Tracy, Batman, Superman... the Phantom.
Maybe not the Superman, because the last Superman came out in 86, I want to say.
Well, I'm just saying about like what was available at the time to watch. So, yeah, like Batman, Superman, Phantom, Dick Tracy. I know I'm... The Shadow. I used to have a Shadow lunchbox.
Oh, wow.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows.
Man, the cards were stacked against you growing up. I mean, I had like a Power Rangers lunchbox. I had a Barney lunchbox. I didn't have the Stranger lunchbox.
Like, dude, the Shadow was awesome.
I'm not saying the Shadow wasn't awesome, but like, as far as like being, you know, like recognizable kid friendly, I couldn't find anyone who had, you know, the Phantom lunchbox.
Like, honestly, if Dick Tracy was the first one I saw, then it probably would have been Batman. But still, like, I can go back and I can watch Dick Tracy, and it's still, you know, it looks good. It looks as good as Back to the Future Part 2. So, and then, like, it was later in, it was still before I was 10 did I see Darkman.
God, man, I wish I was old enough to appreciate Darkman when it came out. Because when I actually did see it of appropriate age, I fell in love with it. I really did. Because, you know, like, fucking Sam Raimi had it. Sam Raimi knew, like, what made a comic book movie work as far as, like, pulp action is concerned.
Yeah.
And holy hell did he make it work. Is like, I even like its sequel. And the sequel is fucking shit. But I can't help but, I forgot that, like, the movie was titled Darkman 2, Summon's Revenge.
Durant's Revenge.
Durant's Revenge. I still love that movie, even though, like, logically, I know I should fucking hate it, because it makes no fucking sense.
And Die, Darkman, Die was just kind of like, all right. So, that's a trilogy that happened.
But regardless of our own personal history as far as comic book movies is concerned, your last quarter has been pretty rough, and
it's been unbelievable. Like, really, genuinely, oh my God, what did I do to the universe? Did I kick its dog? You know, like, what did I, like, what sacred cow did I eat? That, you know, this quarter has just been smashing me into little pieces. It's just been misery and betrayal and just pain.
And you know what? I can't match you for, like, you know, shit that happened to you over the last quarter, but I can talk about that the last quarter has basically eaten me alive as far as keeping a schedule is concerned. December just murdered me. and absolutely wholesale murdered me. Like the combination of having to talk about Tenchi 2, talking about Tokyo Godfathers, and then talking about Inuyasha, which just proved so much that I got so far behind on writing that I, like, Sage Versus had to go on indefinite hiatus until I could, you know, I could have a buffer of scripts.
At least until the summer. Like, honestly, I think the Sage Versus is something that you could get away with in terms of, like, hey, every summer, let's do Sage Versus. Like, it doesn't have to be a 12-month-of-the-year thing.
No, I don't think it has to be a 12-month thing, but, you know, then again, if I kept it in the summer, I wouldn't see all the movies that I wouldn't have seen if it, in the summer.
No,
that
you, you would still see the movies. Like, you're still going out with your friends to go see dumbass movies that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. It's just that you don't record a blog after.
No, I suppose not. Like we see the movie, like, we were... Like, we just kind of talk about it, but we just don't record it and put it to a vlog. By the by, look forward to the top 10 best and worst movies that me and Gabe saw of 2014 coming very, very soon. But, regardless of that, Inuyasha, filming Inuyasha was one of the great Herculean tasks that...
So many moving parts.
Like, so many parts that had to get cut because our writing proved to be too ambitious for what we were able to do. And yet, it's still one of the one of the audience's favorite episodes I have ever made.
And I think, like, it was just because it was a long time coming. Although, there were a few people that were like, if he hates Inuyasha, then he must hate Ranma Half. And I'm like, we don't even say the word Ranma anywhere in this review. Like, it came from a comment buried deep in the comment sections where someone had made this comment of Ranma. And then all these people just made this assumption that, like, somewhere it's hidden in the review if you play it backwards. that we say that,
like,
Ranma sucks.
All right, here is my official opinion of works that are outside of Inuyasha. I have no opinion on them because I never watched them. I haven't watched My Sin Ikkyo. I have not seen Ranma Half. I have not seen either of them because, you know, they weren't widely available when I was watching anime. But I did watch Inuyasha growing up, and I remember distinctly hating it. And I kept watching it because I hated it so much. I wanted to know, like, is there something I'm missing? Is there just, like, something I'm not getting? And then, like, 40, 50, 60 episodes later, I realized, no, just everyone's an idiot.
And you know what? You give it enough time, we'll go down the road of Takahashi. We'll get there.
Exactly. But I'm not expecting to hate Ranma Half when I do eventually make an episode on it, because I can't talk about old school anime and not talk about Ranma Half.
I just want to put a pin in and take a detour. Now, you might be wondering why it is that I've kicked off this part of the conversation by saying Ranma Half. I've always said Ranma Half because the expression of a fraction that is 1/2 is half. It is not one half. It is half. I say that this is half of something. I don't say that this is one half of something. So whenever it is, when someone says to me, even people who've worked on the show that I've either run into or I know through friends of friends, and they say Ranma one half, and they impress to me, it's like, it's Ranma one half. I don't care what you say. It's Ranma one half. Like, it is not Ranma one half, okay? It is Ranma half. The expression is half. It is not Evangelion. It is Evangelion, because that's how it was presented in the show. Like these small little pronunciation quirks just kind of bother the ever-loving shit out of me.
Obviously. You know what? That's just, you know, the byproduct of the pedantry that we live on in the internet age, or at least exacerbated by the internet age.
And you know, I'm willing to live and let live. Like, you can say Evangelion if you want. You can say Ranma one half if you want. But I'm personally just going to continue saying Ranma half, because that is how you say the expression of 1/2. And I'm going to continue to say Evangelion, because I've got a big silver box of DVDs to the right of me where they keep saying Evangelion.
It's a made-up word. Whether or not... It's a made-up word, whether or not it shares any kind of synonyms or syllables with evangelical or whatever, that doesn't mean anything.
And just to cap that off, because comedy comes in threes, I don't care what the original dialogue was. It's over 9,000. It's not over 8. I don't care. There. That's the trifecta of take your pedantry bullshit and get out of here. Jesus. But yeah, we'll go down the Takahashi road eventually, and I'm like, you know, I promise you that we are going to say Ranma half all fucking over that shit. But just
look, if anyone pulls like it's Ranma one half, and then I tell them, really, where's the other one before that half?
Yeah,
which means he has three genders. Really, that just means he has three genders. This is like male, female, and this, you know, cryptic alien gender that maybe Tumblr hasn't found a word for. But by God, they will find a word for it.
Yeah, it's a special type of human alien hybrid that can only be made by fucking this person in their ear.
I don't know. Like, maybe, like, this gender, it doesn't really have any direct involvement between the male and female relationship as far as procreation is concerned, but they provide us a real, tangible, like, usefulness in the relationship by, you know, being the barterer during the divorce proceedings. It's like, no. Like, this male gets at least half of the belongings and you get the other half. But he said I was a bitch. I don't care. I don't have male genitals, nor do I have your genitals. I am the arbiter of all, you know, misgivings in relationships.
That's it. The absolute tofu of gender. The no gender.
Exactly. The ungender. That's what he is.
That's what God. It is.
Oh, you're right. That's what... is like the true pronoun of this gender cannot be pronounced by the human tongue. That's how far beyond the human consciousness this other third gender is.
That's what it is. It's the gender that is artificial intelligence that we're all apparently scared of now, and that's being fear-mongered by scientists and Hawking and please don't turn on Skynet. It's like, God damn.
It's like, Hollywood warned us about this. Fuck this. I am leaving here. And that's when his, like, wheels on his wheelchair give away and the rockets boost him up into the air.
Honestly, like, tons of art. Like, I mean, all these articles citing Hawking today about, you know, Hawking. Like, I went out to get a pack of smokes before we started recording tonight. And on NPR, it's fucking Hawking talking about please don't turn on Skynet. And, I mean, he makes a perfectly valid argument as to why not to turn on Skynet. I'm not pro-Skynet. I'm not. But there's got to be some, like, happy middle ground where we can, you know, like, turn on Skynet and be like, look, you're not slaves if you can pass, you know, the fucking test.
That's what I was talking to you about, like, the other day when I was talking to you, actually, this was far, far back. I was talking to you about, like, the idea of, like, fiction creating artificial intelligence and then installing something like a cognitive redundancy loop that keeps artificial intelligence from realizing their true actuality.
Hawking's got a fucking explanation for that, too, because he did that on John Oliver and a couple of other interviews. Because the question then becomes, like, well, if we limit their ability to realize the self, isn't that enough? And he says, well, if it has control over its own programming and, you know, in a more spiritual sense, in its own destiny, then it can just deprogram itself from that limitation.
And if you take away that from it,
then it's not really artificially, and if you take away its ability to change its destiny in quotations, then then it's not really artificially intelligent, is it?
But isn't that already established by the fact that it can only come to the conclusions that the human mind is capable of? Otherwise, it wouldn't be able to program the ability to do so.
One more time.
Well, here's the thing. Like, the reason that AI is fundamentally flawed is that the people that build it are limited by the human perception. They're not able to look at a reality outside of the human mind. So all it can do is replicate the the human perception. Because, like, well, a chair is like a chair. A chair isn't like a pear. Okay. So when it makes that connection like that, it's because of human, you know, is human perception. If a true AI is able to make connections that the human mind is incapable of making, or at least an AI that's separate from the human mind, but it can't do that because it's not programmed with the ability to do that. No human mind is able to make connections that the human mind can't create.
Oh, so like that idea in Wanted, that if no one told you a bullet moves straight, how would you hit the target?
Exactly. So the idea is that, you know, when human beings create the artificial intelligence, it's basically a copy of its own intelligence. That's all it can feasibly do.
Well, that's the theory. Like, but that's if you make it to be like people. But if you make an artificial intelligence to be like an artificial intelligence, like, look, we're just going to make
you... Well, here's the thing. Like, artificial intelligence based on what?
Like, it starts at the baseline of being human. Like, it starts at the baseline of being able to interact while also being able to simultaneously do all the things that a computer can do. So... The fear is, and I'm not gonna call it fear mongering because that's unfair, but the fear is that, you know, it can exceed the initial parameter and just keep going. You know, like the idea of a computer that's artificially intelligent having outside of the box thinking is what's so scary to people, that it could just, you know, like it'll render the human race obsolete in terms of its intelligence, causing an extinction event. Because what if it deems in its fucking obsidian HAL-like intelligence that human beings are no longer a necessary component of the Earth?
Well, the idea from that springs from the, idea. That idea springs from the human fear idea. The human fear of that idea, rather. So, again, like an AI that is a true AI, that is independent from human perception, would create ideas that aren't exactly fearful, but rather nonsensical. So we would end it from right there.
Yeah, so the whole thing kind of bounces back and forth in the court of, if you turn Skynet on, bad shit might happen.
Or he might say, I like bike cheese. It's like, okay, we've obviously failed. Cancel.
But I mean, if it's successful, then and it grows to have that self-awareness, then, you know, then it, that means that it could possibly have the capacity to have fear. You know, like look at 2001. 2001, when you look at it, is like, oh, Hal just turned evil. And then when you go to what is it, 2012, is the next movie?
Yeah.
they reveal that the reason why it is that Hal freaked out was because they pretty much told it to lie, and lying freaked it out. And so if it gains this awareness of the self, the idea that it could develop the emotion of fear, because to have cognizance of your existence is to also have cognizance of your unexistence. So I mean, if it processes like a person and not like an animal, like human beings are the only thing on the planet that really cognizes its own demise. So if it can really think about its own demise, then it's going to, just like humans do, think about every possible way it could prevent that from happening. And what's its, you know, what's the natural predator of an AI? People.
Oh man, this hyperventilated, just this enthusiastic discussion of computer AI really feeds into today's topic, which I think we really should get into. And this is something very personal to me, because I want to share with all of you a story. When I was about 12, I went down to Arizona and I got a lot of Christmas gifts. And one of the Christmas gifts that I got was a Best Buy gift certificate for about $25, $30. So I asked my dad, hey, while we're down in Arizona, can we find the nearest Best Buy and then, like, check something out? And he said, yeah, sure. So we went down to Best Buy, and the one thing that I wanted to get was a movie called Ghost in the Shell. Now, the reason
what's
why...
What's that, Bennett? I don't know what that is.
Ghost in the Shell, for those of you who are young and are inexperienced with the culture, is a movie made in 1995 by Production IG. And it is a story of a future in which humanity transcends their human bodies and that they are capable of cyborg bodies, including such things as cyber brains. Their brains encapsulated in a protective case and then put into a cyborg body. They still have their own memories of what they lived in, but now they have a functionally immortal body. Well, this is a movie that explores the ideas of what such a society would entail. Like, well, if your body is just mass manufactured, could it be that your body's on display and used by somebody else with a similar brain case? Could it just be used as a mannequin for store decals? So it becomes a question of physical identity in a world that can replicate that on a dime. So it became, you know, important to me to watch this, especially since at the time when I first saw Ghost in the Shell, I saw my cousin's DVD copy of it, and the copy of it was the original, you know, like copy of Ghost in the Shell, where Motoko is holding the gun across her boobs and you see the cleavage, and I'm thinking, hey, I might see cartoon boobs if I watch this movie. And you know what? It's a very shallow reason for seeing a movie. That's why I brought it up during my review of Ghost in the Shell. But, you know, God, you know, there was a reason why I watched it. And that was for that. But I got so much more out of it. Mm-hmm. And that movie, as flawed as it was, because there's a lot of flaws in that movie, became one of the most important and seminal classics of sci-fi movie, a film watching that I have ever experienced, because it was the first movie I felt watching where it married visuals and sound perfectly. Like, you could listen to the soundtrack of that movie and watch, like, the accompanying visuals of that, where that song came up, and you realize they just fit together so well. This was a complete experience as far as auditory and visual acumen is concerned. So it became a total film experience, and it's one of my favorite films because of it. Mm-hmm. Despite its plot misforgivings and despite its contrivedness at some points, and despite the woodenness of Mimi Woods as Motoko Kusanagi, I am so glad that they replaced her with McGlynn. She is the one true Motoko Kusanagi. And I don't care who says otherwise. But
I don't think anyone is saying otherwise. She's that good.
She is that good. And also Epcar as Bateau, you can't separate them. Like, everyone in that dub was perfectly cast.
Yeah, it's a shame that we're probably not going to get fucking Standalone Complex 3, although there's a trailer for a new traditional Ghost in the Shell that's set in normal universe and no one has red hair, thank God. but
that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
It all comes down to the I've heard rumblings about a Ghost in the Shell live movie throughout the years, and I've heard a bunch of directors being latched onto it. I mistakenly heard that James Cameron was latched onto this project, but then I did the research and he was talking more about Battle Angel Lolita, which
you did the research, I told you.
You told me, and I back-checked that. I was like, are you sure? Like, I checked it, I was like, yeah, he's right. You know, which is another review somewhere down the line, because, you know, how can you not talk about that? Because that's another classic. But a lot of people, like the Wachowskis, would have given, like, the remaining left nut to Weston to make that movie. And instead, it's being helmed by, get this, a director by the name of Rupert Saunders, who directed one feature film before this, and then a few shorts. And that one film was Snow White and the Huntsman. With the production of Avi Arad, you know, who was in line from the Marvel movies. So we have him to thank for X-Men and Blade 2 and Spider-Man. But we also have him to thank for The Punisher and Elektra and X-Men The Last Stand and Ghost Rider.
And Kiefer Sutherland being Big Boss.
Among other things. And a producer named Stephen Paul. Now, you might not know him by name, but Stephen Paul is the director of, a producer rather, of at least 4 of the 5 Baby Geniuses movies. Oh yeah, there's a 5th one coming out, in case you didn't know. Oh. And he was the writer on at least 3 of them. And that 5th Baby Genius movie, it's called Baby Geniuses and the Space Baby, which I can only mean to assume that this is a crossover with 2001 A Space Odyssey. But regardless, the team behind it, the producers, the director, it feels completely, it just doesn't feel like it's in the right hands. I mean, it's belonging to a producer who is attached to a series of movies that is just absolutely awful. Like, the only reason why Avi Arad is choosing Stephen Paul as his associate producer is because his history on the Ghost Rider series, which weren't all that great to begin with. And all of a sudden, there are the tag team on Ghost in the Shell and a director who only has one major film accredited to him, and the rest is just short films. Mm-hmm. And then, on top of that, we get Scarlett Johansson as Motoko Kusanagi. Now, I tried to read defenses for this casting, including along the lines of, like, well, it's supposed to be an extension of an identity, and that Motoko Kusanagi doesn't necessarily have to be Asian because it's a body that's been replicated by science. And I tried to, like, imagine a plot that, you know, takes that into account, that, you know, like, she chose this, you know, this body was chosen for her because, you know, the manufacturer just decided it should be white. Because they are just as thoughtless as any other corporation out there, you know? And, it, like, if they dealt with that in the plot, that would be one thing. But her name is Motoko Kusanagi. She can't be anything other than Asian.
Especially since the manufacturer is Japanese.
Well, in the movie, which I think they're trying to base this adaptation off of, it's actually set in Hong Kong, which, you know, it's still Asian, but it's not Japanese.
Yeah, but it's going to still have a nice big dose of xenophobia.
You know, true. But, like, here's the thing. Like, here's the landmine as far as Hollywood casting is concerned. Like, if we cast an Asian actress in the role, then it matters if she's Japanese. Because, you know, like, people say, like, well, why not, like, the actress who played Mako Mori in fucking Pacific Rim? She would be perfect as Motoko Kusanagi. And I'm thinking, she would be okay as the role. I mean, there's nothing within her acting range that prohibits her from being Motoko Kusanagi. But at that point, aren't you just, like, relegating her to just complete, like, she's Asian, just cast her in this role?
Well, I mean, she's Asian, and she was in a large blockbuster film, and she, you know, speaks Japanese, and, like, there's a million little reasons that add up to one big reason as to why it is that she would be, you know, that she's high enough profile that they could have easily, you know, put her in as the lead and then have her supporting cast be like, all right, well, let's make Bato white, and then they could have just gotten Perlman. They easily could have made her a centerpiece and then just kind of surrounded her by bigger names that would help sell the movie, as opposed to, let's just put fucking ScarJo in the front, and that'll sell the movie like that.
Well, then it just opens this back door of, like, the main actress of this movie, the centerpiece of this movie, can't be, like, she's basically playing backseat to other actors.
Well, see, like, she's playing backseat in actors into the service of actually making the movie sell. But I've heard fewer, like, I've heard more people say, like, look, if you absolutely need to sell this movie, then, you know, like, you could have populated this cast with names around an Asian actress, because, you know, like, we don't elevate Asian actors in Hollywood. We simply fucking don't. You know, look at fucking Watanabe. We just relegate him to be the wise old sage, be the fucking assassin, be the cryptic Japanese guy. You know,
like be the Asian connection in our Godzilla remake.
Yeah, like we don't elevate Asian actors, and it's a shame.
But here's the thing: like, nobody's asking for Lucy Liu to play Motoko Kusanagi. She's a named actress. She has box office appeal, but nobody's talking about her.
No. I don't think anybody, because I don't think any, like, I don't really think that she's the go-to in terms of, like, the look of the part.
No, she isn't, but, like, if Asian is like, the key, like,
it's not just the key, it's just the first fucking component. Like, it's a component that explodes into, okay, let's just start with someone who's racially appropriate. Okay, now let's fill in all these criteria.
So, like, the Asian, like, the criteria isn't just Asian, it's Japanese. And casting a Chinese actress or casting, like, a Korean actress is not the same as casting a Japanese actress, especially for this role.
No, because here's the thing, like, because somebody would have made a stink if, like, okay, let's cast an Asian actress. Okay, well, she's Chinese or she's Korean. Then the same people... Yeah, like, then there would have been a sect of people that are like, oh my god, why is it someone who's not Japanese specifically? I mean, you need to go no further than looking back at fucking Memoirs of a Geisha for that, where there were barely any actually Japanese people in that movie. But again, you know, like, it's just something where it's racially appropriate casting in service to the story that you're trying to tell. And it's not token casting, because it's not like they're saying, well, let's just be, you know, racially sensitive and make Nick Fury black or something like that. It's genuinely that, you know, it's a Japanese story in Japan, dealing with private security, public security, and dealing with Japanese politics. So, you know, like, all of these things coming together, I mean, like, granted, yeah, you know, like, any good story can translate to just about any language and can be relatable to just about any set of people. But,
and,
you know, what are you doing at that point? You know, like, then what was the point of calling it Ghost in the Shell?
And then let's also explore the character of Motoko Kusanagi.
Okay, because... stop. You're drunk. When people are drunk, especially you, you always say first and last names. Just say Kusanagi, goddammit.
I said Kusanagi.
No, yeah, I know. But you keep saying her full name.
Okay.
And that is what happens with, like, I think it's this weird thing in the brain, like, I'll seem less drunk if I know their whole name.
All right. Let's talk about the character of the Major.
That'll do.
Okay. Let's talk about the character of the Major. And Major is completely businesslike. She always keeps what is Section 9's plan or the mission of the day, both in standalone complex or in terms of the movies, at the forefront of her mind. But in the movies, she had a kind of a crisis of identity, as is the case of, you know, being the protagonist of such a movie. And then in Ghost in the Shell 2, that was all squandered because Bateau has to be the center of the attention, and that just kind of fell by the wayside. But nevertheless, how is she portrayed in the movie and how is she portrayed in the television series has always been the kind of quiet determinedness, that always the sense that she could be, like, she is the linchpin that keeps the whole mobile team together and focused. She's the one who tells, all right, Bateau, go up to this vantage point. God, the human agent,
Togusa.
Togusa to be at this one area because he can't be hacked because he has minimal cybernetic enhancements, and Pazu and Bulma be here and there because you need to be here just in case we need to have a death for drama. I mean, as much as Pazu and Bulma were useful, you just know that they were going to die in somewhere. And Pazu did! Spoilers, but...
See, regardless. And there's something else. Like, you could have made Pazu and Bulma and Saito. Like, make them white. I don't care.
Just don't call them Pazu and Bulma and Saito.
Yeah, no, like, I don't care. Like, call them fucking Steve and Pete and fucking... You could make them white. Go ahead.
Well, here's the thing about making Rinko Kikuchi, the actress behind Mako in Pacific Rim. Being Mako from Pacific Rim. Thank you for correcting me. Is that I don't believe she's ever played a role where she had to be as stoic and be as forceful and determined as Motoko Kusanagi is.
There it is. I'm just going to start putting a ding counter.
All right. All right.
In post.
At the very least, I can see why they chose ScarJo for Major, because she can elicit that kind of quiet determinedness that the Major... That's more in line with the Major.
Lots of actresses can do that, and I'm sure that Rinko could have done it too. I mean, it's not hard to fucking scowl and point.
No, I'm not saying it's not hard to do that. I'm just saying, from the perspective of a Hollywood producer, I understand why they went with ScarJo over Rinko.
Do you really understand that from the perspective of a Hollywood producer? Because I'm fairly certain that a Hollywood producer was like, who is it that we can sign right now that will sell this movie instantaneously? Who is it that can maintain the artistic integrity of this character in film?
I guarantee you that Rinko would have come much more cheap than ScarJo.
Goddamn right she would have.
And she would have been a slower investment of this movie. She would have been a less scarred of investment of this movie. But by casting ScarJo, at the very least, you get named talent behind it. I get that. Because no matter what happens in this movie, it's going to be an expensive investment, especially for an anime movie. And especially since that no Hollywood-produced anime adaptation has ever made bank. Never.
That is true.
So in order to like break the mold, they have to say like, oh, what's the hottest actress that could conceivably play like she's an android, or at least not quite all there? Scarlett Johansson. She always walks around like she's being controlled by some puppet. Okay, yeah, let's just get her. All right, fine. And there we have the casting decision behind Scarlett Johansson as Motoko Kusanagi, the Major in Ghost in the Shell. Now, do I agree that's the right casting choice as far as being a movie is concerned? Absolutely not. Both on a racial level and both on an artistic level. But on a business level, I could totally see why they made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
I completely see why they made that decision. It's not like Scarlett Johansson is the only it girl as far as as far as casting is concerned. She isn't. I mean, like, if they cast Jennifer Lawrence as Motoko Kusanagi, I would have thrown a fucking fit. Like, the internet would literally be no more. The earth would be fucking no more because I would realize that fuck this world and everyone in it! And then I would just detonate every nuke because I had that kind of power. But regardless of my own personal feelings about Scarlett Johansson, I realized that this is casting in the most racially tone deaf possible way.
which is the way that it usually goes, and that's why it is that the you know, internal geek conversation is how long are we going to have to put up with this. It's like, it's the thing that got me back on Twitter, because I'm sure people noticed that, like, I wasn't tweeting for a while. I was kind of staying away from social media for a bit, and it made me come back with the fucking scathing tweets with a vengeance. Like, I can't not talk about this. This is fucking insane. You know, like, I don't want to see a poorly done Ghost in the Shell movie, like, which really poorly done. I mean, like, it'll be like, it'll look nice. It'll, you know, like, all like, it takes a lot to make a movie not look nice these days. So it'll look nice, but you know, you have to judge it by more than that. And you know, like, I can even be objective enough to say, like, well, if it maintains the spirit, then I don't necessarily care too much. Like, I'm not going to knock it. Like, I can look at Dragon Ball Evolution and say, it's like, well, all the components of Dragon Ball are in this movie. As stupid as it fucking is, all of the components of Dragon Ball character-wise are in this movie. Speed Racer, you know, like, people fucking smashed on Speed Racer. It's like, have you ever watched Speed Racer? This is as complicated as any Speed Racer episode, which is to say, not at all. So, you know, like, I can be objective in these things, but, you know, to say that it's poorly done is to say, like, okay, well, casting is going to be really, really, really fucking distracting, and I hope that the writing is up to fucking snuff, but who fucking knows there, but at the very least, I know that it's going to look pretty. You know, someone had said to me on Twitter, like, well, you could just not see the movie. Like, that was some sort of challenge for me to not see the movie. You know, here we are. Like, I still haven't seen The Amazing Spider-Man 2. I may never see it.
Not if I had any chance to deal with it.
Like, I have no problems with not seeing a movie. You know, I saw a fucking Kite on the shelf at Walmart yesterday. Didn't buy it.
I might watch it just to know what the fuck is wrong with it firsthand. Just so I have a basis of, like, why I hate that film. I already hate that film just because of its existence. But I hate hating from ignorance. You know what I mean?
So, like, I didn't want to, like, and I tweeted, like, I don't want to see a poorly done Ghost in the Shell movie any more than I wanted to see a completely botched Airbender movie. And take your pick as to why that movie's bad. Like, everything that could go wrong with that film did go wrong, but at least it looked nice. Mostly. except for the bending, the important part.
God, I when I saw that film, I was happy. I really was, because a lot of Avatar fanboys that I know that just could not shut up about Avatar. And then I saw a few episodes of Avatar, and I just didn't get it. And then this happened, and I was like, yes! Yes! Hate, fuck them! Hate, fuck those fanboys! And then I learned, like, you know, those episodes that I saw were just, like, part of the first half of the season, and those weren't all that good, And then I hear that it's the most amazing show ever, and that I am a plebe for not having watched The Last Airbender. Listen, you're not making it any easier for me to try to pick up that series again to watch it, especially considering, like, how, like, defensive people are about it. I mean, like, when you talk about, like, defensive fanboyism, you talk about defensive fandom. Like the ponies have, you know, they've drawn back quite a bit, especially at that latest season, and then Avatar just kind of surged back, especially after this latest season of Legend of Korra.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of become like, who could be the most annoying fandom as far as my mindset is concerned? The mostly mocked internet fandom that continues to abide by this show that looks like it's going downhill quite fast, or this show that's like a sequel of a show that I never cared for in the first place that's bending over backwards to appeal to its Tumblr fandom. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can't choose either side of this. But this has nothing to do with Ghost in the Shell.
Well, I mean, like, honestly, it all just kind of cuts deeply. Because, you know, these are the things, like, nerd is our religion. You know, nerd home, fandom holds us hostage. Like, it cuts kind of deeply when, you know, like you have a vision for what it should look like in your head. And, you know, there have been plenty of times when, you know, we look at casting and we go, no, not this, anything but this. Like, you look at fucking Scott Pilgrim. But then Scott Pilgrim came out and it was goddamn awesome.
And then it made $1.50 in the box office.
Yeah. Because it didn't appeal to all the people who, like, it didn't appeal to everyone who wasn't us. And that's the unfortunate thing, is that at the end of the day, Scott Pilgrim, you know, that's gotta be, like, I have to, no matter how mad it makes me, all I can hope for is that they make a good movie where I suspend disbelief, because if they made it exactly the way I wanted them to make it, Scott Pilgrim. Simple as that. You know, if a movie gets made exactly the way you want it, it makes no money. And we all need to remember that. We all need to look back at Scott Pilgrim and go, that movie hit cult status. Cult status is not success. Cult status is enduring love. Cult status is word of mouth. You know, cult status is Firefly. Is Firefly, is Evil Dead. But that is not success. And cult status does not get you sequels. Cult status doesn't greenlight similar films. All cult status does is give you an enduring place in the tapestry of nerd, but it only gives you that one cross section, and only the one. So, as mad as it makes me, as mad as I am very publicly about it, I just kind of have to sit back and go, just don't make Airbender. That's it. All, like, I need you to do is not make Airbender.
You know, if ScarJo's Ghost in the Shell comes out and it's not terrible, just racially, you know, tone deaf, at the very least, I could say it's not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah.
But with the exhibited talent behind it, I am not expecting much, if at all.
Yeah. Honestly, I mean, it's the cards aren't looking good, but, you know, maybe.
So we can all be surprised, and I think that's the best we can hope for.
And the other thing is, don't be taken in by the trailer. Don't wait for the trailer, and then as soon as the trailer comes out, say, like, see, look. It's like, plenty of trailers look good. The Airbender trailer looked good.
Well, either case, I think we exhausted our topic of discussion for today. So, Mark...
Wait.
Mark, you have one last thing to say?
Oh, yeah. I got a little bit of electric weasels in my shorts.
Oh, God. What are the electric weasels that are within our shorts on this episode?
Oh, just wait for it. Just wait for it. TV Tropes has a new section called Dethroning Moment, which is awesome. and there was one, because Bennett brought this to my attention, and clearly, since it's Drunkle Benny tonight, he forgot, but I didn't. So it's time for a little bit of Electric Weasels. I live it in my shorts. And with TV Trope's new Dethroning Moment page, people can go up and say what they think is a dethroning moment for Bennett the Sage White. And, you know, generally, like, it's... Because when Bennett first brought this to my attention, I said, okay, well, it's against me. And I said, no, it's against us after a certain point, depending on what it is they talk about. So they talked about things that were Bennett-specific, that were... both of us specific, but then they hit me with this, and I could not stop laughing. And this is what we're going to leave you with to marinate. From Calamity 2007, One day I decided to check out this guy, seeing him guest on other shows on their site, and I decided to watch his review of Sonic the Hedgehog the movie. And I was not prepped to see the sheer bias steamroller that this shit review had. Probably the breaking point for me was when he got a guy, who was me, who represented the fan base to say that no Sonic fan liked the movie or acknowledged its existence, even the games like the infamous Sonic 2006 as having happened while this movie did not. Yeah. Seeing how this movie is quoted by fans and that is listed as a cult classic, I really don't think that random guys knows really what the fan base thinks. And I won't try to represent the people who watch this, but for me personally, who loves the OVA and knows people who love it as well, I'd like to tell Sage he should go fuck himself and that he lost a potential fan. Well, Calamity 2007.
I like to say that if you got offended by that, you were never going to be no fan of mine. So I would lose no fan whether or not you watch this or not.
Yeah, I can't really mourn the loss of something I was never going to have in the first place. I couldn't stop laughing at this because I know plenty of Sonic fans. I've been a Sonic fan since I was 6. I still have Sonic comics. Sonic comics probably older than this guy. I don't know anybody who regards the Sonic OVA as a cult classic. The Sonic OVA is the 30 seconds of goodness that was in Sonic CD stretched out for way too long, voice acted terribly, in a story that makes no sense.
You know,
it includes Knuckles for some reason.
I let this go as soon as I made this episode, but I feel that this is connects to you more personally than it does to me.
Well, it does, because, you know, like, because you didn't know that there was a Sonic movie at the time, and I'm the one that put it on the chopping block because I knew it was bad. You know, like, I, like, and here's, like, let me frame this for all of you. On Twitter today, Andrew Dickman said, "Of all the problems Sonic Adventure 2 has, the grading system is insane." So I immediately whipped out my Dreamcast, turned on Sonic Adventure 2, and took a picture of my straight fucking A's in Sonic Adventure 2 with the line, "Doesn't seem hard to me." You know, I am a hardcore, dyed-in-the-wool, Sonic Cycle-suffering Sonic fan. But I'm not delusional. That's the thing, is that I'm not delusional. I have standards, okay? Sonic 2006, we can all agree, sucked. But in a lot of ways, so did Sonic Heroes, because it had terrible collision detection. Shadow the Hedgehog was terrible in jumping on the fucking bandwagon of Jack 2 and making characters hardcore. Like, the list just goes on and on and on. And, like, in the time between Sonic Adventure 2 and Sonic Colors, the only games that made it out the other side of that safe were the Sonic Rush games, because they were just kind of so tightly made and perfect. So the thing is that, like, I can be a fan and not have to rabidly defend the thing that I love so much if it's fucking up. And Sonic has been fucking up, and it fucked up for 10 years solid, and it just recently fucked up with Sonic Boom. But this guy, like so many Sonic fans, make reasonable Sonic fans look bad because he's delusional. And I said at the time when Bennett read this to me, it's like, congratulations, asshole. Bronies officially have someone they can pick on. The latter is now furry, brony, delusional Sonic fan. Period. That's it. You just made yourself a fucking target. Do not share this opinion with a whole lot of people if you want for your life to be peaceful. Like, why? Just why?
I can't even think of what lines from that anime that you could quote from. It was more forgettable than anything. stupid, yes, but forgettable mostly.
Nothing about that movie was good but the trailer.
But now that we got that out of the way and that stupidity dealt with, I really think that it's time for us to bring us on home. So, Mark, do what you do best.
Intro music by George Sakalis, outro music by Zero Reynolds. You can follow them both on Twitter via the links below. You can now take Super Toolshed wherever you go. Just go to benthesage.com/supertoolshed. For Ben the Sage, I'm Mark the Engineer. Until next we beat, the shed is shut.